The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Shobogenzo, Fascicle on Buddha Nature. The Buddha said, if you want to understand Buddha nature, you should intimately observe cause and effect over time. When the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. We've been studying Buddha nature all ongo. We've been studying Buddha nature for 42 years. Buddha nature is something that was not really so present in early Buddhism, but became very important in Mahayana Buddhism. And it's kind of tricky because it's so important. Mazumi Roshi says, quoting Tore Zenji, a successor of Hakuin, who said that if you wish to realize the way, you must first of all raise great faith. And then he outlined 10 stages of deepening faith, beginning with the faith that each of us has the nature and boundless wisdom of all Buddhas, and ending with this faith, which comes after one has accomplished the way. He says, actually, though the beginning and end of our practice is whether we really believe in ourselves as the Buddha, when you clearly realize this truth and you're truly enlightened, then there's nothing but the sharing of your realization of yourself as the Buddha with others. Unless you do this, it's difficult to be compassionate. Seeing yourself as the Buddha, believing and realizing this, you can't be anything but compassionate. So I would really encourage you to have this strong and deep faith in yourself. And though this be true, Buddha nature is not something that we can directly touch, encounter in a knowing way. And so that's why we have faith in Buddha nature. We have faith in those things that are not so readily discernible or accessible, right? You don't have faith that you have a nose, right? We don't use faith in that way. That's why faith plays such an important role in spiritual practice, because in any genuine spiritual or religious practice, which is to help us encounter what is beyond measure, what is beyond knowing, we have to step into that very immeasurable unknowing and have faith, have confidence in something that we don't actually know yet. We don't know to be true. And that's a leap. In a way, that's asking a lot, which is why faith in that way is tough for some folks who want to sort of, you know, have everything in the contract spelled out clearly before committing, but it just doesn't work that way. But we only need enough faith to take a step and then another. And then on the basis of that, practicing within that faith, because we don't just have faith alone. We have faith along with or embedded within, running through, supporting, inspiring practice. Otherwise, it would just be a leap. It would not be anything that would be verified. And so he said, with the Four Noble Truths, that we should first understand the first noble truth of dukkha, book of it, but also that all conditioned existence is dukkha, which is a very broad, all-encompassing statement. And then the cause of dukkha, of our disappointment, our dissatisfaction, this we need to relinquish, the thirst, the grasping, the clinging. To realize nirvana or enlightenment, the liberation of dukkha, is something that we need to realize. That needs to be directly encountered. And then the path, the fourth noble truth, needs to be practiced. And because we can't touch Buddha nature directly, we work with what we can touch in a certain sense. And so we work with our mind and sensations and emotions and thoughts and memories and body phenomena. And in the beginning, we're largely working with everything on the basis of how it appears to us. We're working with the appearances, the characteristics, the ways, the attributes, the ways things show up to us, so that in the ways in which we recognize them. But what practice is helping us to do is, though we're, in a sense, practicing on the surface, we need to understand it at its deepest level. And in understanding, in order to understand things at the deepest level, we have to be intimately familiar with what's on the surface. And so surface here doesn't mean superficial, although we can have a superficial practice, which is not trying to have depth. But without that, without those, in a sense, those two working together, and so Buddha nature, bodhicitta, are spoken of as having two elements, the elements of the relative, that which we can practice, we can cultivate, in a sense we can move towards, that's just a way of speaking, and then the ultimate aspect, which is ungraspable. And without both of those working together, what's on the surface, what's deep within, it's hard to go beyond just kind of what we've been doing, controlling our actions and behavior, you know, following the precepts that way, rather than really illuminating cause and effect. The precepts become rules to follow, rather than these very profound teachings on non-duality. Training can, in many moments, just appear confining. Like, why do we do things this way? Why does it have to be this way? Practice becomes something we just do rather than dharma that's actualized. I was speaking the other day, I think, about the ways in which practicing together as one body, which the precautions at the beginning of session are helping us to enter into from the surface. What do you do with your body? What do you do with your words? What do you do with your hands? What do we do with the stuff that we have? Put it away. Make your bed. Put your cups away. All of that. Right? Because we're all here together. And if we don't do that, then we're not practicing as one body. And so all of these subtle ways, like the posture, all of these subtle aspects of the posture, which are helping us to embody this profound wakefulness and this profound ease, which allows everything within us to be open rather than closed, to be bright rather than dim, to be trusting rather than anxious. The profound nature of a bow, a prostration, of chanting together, of the schedule, all of these different aspects, right? Showing up on time. So if we look at that just at the surface, it's like, well, just be on time, like at work, you're supposed to be on time. And you might cheat it a little, because it's just a rule. But what is it when it's not a rule and we are practicing to go beyond the rules? What happens, right? If my inclination is to, you know, not be on time, let's say. So what is happening here? Resistance, rebellion, sluggishness, procrastination, what? because that's dukkha. Dogen says the words to understand Buddha nature did not only mean to know Buddha nature, but also to practice it, to realize it, to expound it, to expound it through the whole body and mind. And then Dogen says, and then to let go of it. So during Fusatsu, I talked about in the faith, in the Lotus Sutra, all of the passages that talk about this in relationship to the Lotus Sutra, to chant it, to recite it, to embrace it, to copy it, to expound it. And I said, what if you yourself are the Lotus Sutra? In calling single-mindedly the name of Kanon, what if you yourself are Kanon Bodhisattva? So as you practice Buddha nature, as Buddha nature, realize it, expound it, and then let go of it. Having traveled this far, we see there is nothing to carry, nothing to hold on to. And this is everyday practice. This is Sesshin, this is Ango, each moment, each day, each season, wholehearted, undivided, non-grasping. And those words, you know, that way of speaking about it can sort of set up, I mean, they're accurate. There's grasping, there's letting go of grasping. And in a way, that's what we can do. We recognize that. We recognize when we're holding on to something and we need to release it. But it also sets up a kind of false sense of something in our mind. You know, to practice non-attachment kind of can set up the sense of, oh, you don't get to have any attachments. You don't get to have any attachments. Right? They're being taken away from you. Go to your room without any attachments. Rather than practice the precepts, right? Don't create any negative karma. Rather than, oh, I don't have to have any attachments. Oh, thank goodness. Dogen says expounding it, practicing it, realizing it, letting go of it, as well as missing it and not missing it, are all cause and effect over time. The cause and effect that we are to be observing. So to miss Buddha nature, as well as to not miss it, all are cause and effect. In a sense, he's saying, I hear him saying to us, don't be wasteful, don't waste anything. Don't let anything pass by unnoticed. Don't throw away what still has life in it, what still has usefulness. What would we cast away, right? What are the moments of the day? What are the situations? What are the objects? What are the awarenesses that we would cast away as having nothing to do with ourselves, with each other, with life, with the Dharma, with mindfulness? Which means it's really up to each of us to discover, to learn deeply, how do we receive all of this Dharma as food? How do we receive all of this food as Dharma? Tibetan teachers often talk about put everything into the path, bring everything in service to the path. In the Ahishengi, the rules of monastic life of Master Dogen, he talks about food, and we can think of food here as phenomena in relationship to the Dharma. And he says, whoever sees fundamental equality, unity, sameness in food, sees the same equality in all Dharmas. And here he's meaning about the mental, emotional, physical dharmas, all the constituent parts of your experience, everything that arises within you. If these dharmas are equal, then we can, to each other, they all have the same nature. Every wave on the ocean has the same nature. Then we can also assert that that same equality is true regarding food or phenomena. If one should see these dharmas to be equal, to food, then we should also see food to be equal to these dharmas. All things are Buddha nature. I spoke the other night, I think, in Vasatsu about how having all the same nature, we all have the same nature. We are all also equally human beings. That's something we share. So that, if we think of that as something we can touch, we can see, we can measure to a certain degree, the different aspects of our humanity that are different, different features, we appear differently, but we all are the same being. We're all human beings. And then looking beneath the surface, and the surface alone is very difficult, isn't it, for us to see as equal. But if we look beneath the surface to realize the Buddha nature, the essence, our original self, mu, shunyata, all of these are different words, emptiness, for this basic self nature. And so we have all arrived here, in a sense, in the same place, and we've arrived here differently. And so, in a sense, we are all practicing the same dharma, but we're not all practicing it the same way. We're all practicing one dharma, but there are different teachings and practices within that one dharma. Because within that unity, there is also individuality, uniqueness. And so the actions of our lifetime, many of them skillful, many of them not so skillful, were all instrumental in bringing us here. Every action, every intentional action has consequence. And so in that way, we are constantly shaping, molding, creating our life and being molded, shaped, and created. And so what Dogen is saying is that we want to learn how to utilize our delusion. You know, we just want to, like, get rid of it. But really, you can't, one, because it's not a thing, right? And two, because that's a not correct view. That's a false view. Practicing that view will inevitably set us against ourselves, against exactly what we're trying to do. It will perpetuate, because that, in a sense, already is the view that we have. And so we have to really learn how to utilize our delusion, which means we have to make our peace with it. Not succumb to it, not be at the mercy of it, but make our peace with it. Be peaceful within our delusion. At the same time that we are very diligent and effortful because it causes suffering. And so in our peacemaking, we don't become complacent or passive. But in our effort, we don't become aggressive and conflicted. And we're maturing that capacity to practice, to steward, to guide, to use well all that appears. And so we use our vows, we use cultivating compassion, metta practices, we use the very stark, naked, bare, profound practice of Zazen. It's like when you're sitting and something arises and you acknowledge it, that's equal to saying, this is. And then you let it go. And that's equal to saying, this is not. This is. This comes with an appearance. This has qualities. Right? I feel the influence of this as it arises within me. I see the construction. It is. It exists. And then we let go. It is not its appearances. It does exist, but not as it appears to exist. Dogen says, you observe cause and effect over time through observation of cause and effect over time. You can observe it with a whisk, a staff, and so forth. However, you may also observe it through the wisdom of desire, the wisdom of beyond desire, of original enlightenment, embryonic enlightenment, no enlightenment, or true enlightenment. Has he left anything out? So he's saying you can, first of all, it takes time. We have to observe it over time. And to really reflect on that, why? Why can't we just observe it in one shining moment, realize it in one radiant moment, and be free? Why do we have to observe it over time? And then he says we can use all of these objects, phenomena, external, internal, and at the same time, you may observe it through the wisdom of your desires, the very desires we're supposed to be relinquishing in the Four Noble Truths. But also, you can study it by going beyond desire. The great way is not difficult, just have no preferences. You can study it through original enlightenment, Buddha nature, ungraspable, through embryonic enlightenment, light is beginning to come through, but it's not clear, it's not well developed, it's not integrated. No enlightenment or true enlightenment. In other words, at every step, all along the way, over time. Time is not the enemy. We have to practice over time. That's why perseverance is so important. It's not just to keep at it, you know, to keep persevering when it's difficult, but it's when it's not difficult. It's to practice over time, because so much only happens in time. You know, it's like when monastics are in discernment and they have a bad moment or a bad day or a bad month, right? So one could conclude, well, this isn't working. This must not be what my life is to be, right? But then if they persevere, if they observe over time, then that shifts. And there are other experiences that they have. And over continued time, which is why it takes some years, then there's a whole body of experience within which to observe. It takes time to observe cause and effect, to study the self. And that means through all of the seasons and the states and the circumstances and the changes. It means observing cause and effect when you're in your zone, right? You can't wait to get to your cushion. You have faith. The chanting is filling you. You don't ever want to stop. And then when you don't ever want to begin, right? You've forgotten why you came here. You've forgotten why you're practicing. It seems all dried up, not going according to plan. You're being let down everywhere you look. Within hell realms and peaceful realms. You know, I think I spoke earlier this week about it. I often have thought of the Buddha, you know, as I spoke under that Bodhi tree, sitting with this resolution. Like this resolution that he was going to enlighten his mind, and then Mara comes to try and get him up. Come on, there are other things you should be doing. This is a waste of time. Who are you kidding? Come on. Look at all these wonderful things you could be doing. And just staying put. And I've always thought of it, oh, there's this cascade, this symphony, this opera, right, of characters and situations and events, all, some of them challenging through temptation, some through war and battle. And the power of just staying there with his eyes open. I was remembering again when I was a teenager and sort of experiencing my first love. And my grandparents were visiting, and they'd been married a long time, and they really loved each other. And it was clear, you could see it. And I remember sort of feeling that, you know, youthful love that I was feeling as a teenager. And then I was watching them and thinking, that's different. And having the sense, I don't think you get that at 15. He says, intimately observe is not limited to observing, being observed, correct observation or wrong observation. It's intimately observed. It's not self-observation or others' observation. It is cause and effect as it is over time, and it is beyond cause and effect. It is Buddha nature as it is. It is becoming free of the body of Buddha nature. It is Buddha and Buddha as they are, and nature as they are. The moment we try to domesticate it, narrow it down, focus it, come on, let's make this manageable, please. Dogen takes that away. No. Yes, no. Yes, no. And so we observe the self, study the self through cause and effect, through actions and consequences, through applying ourselves and then observing. And through self-awareness, Dogen says, so we observe our projections, how we create things in our mind, but we also observe self-awareness free of projections when we're not adding anything. We study the self through others' awareness, through seeing others, through our projections of them, not projecting onto them, you. We observe through cause and effect, through time, through others' awareness, being seen by others, their projections on us, others not projecting on us. And finally, through no awareness at all, no observation, no study. The Buddha says, the Bodhisattva does not course in, I am observing, I am aware, I am mindful, I am doing zazen. We don't need to do that. Just practice. And so we see the self that arises due to karma, due to our creations, due to our history, due to our habits. And we learn skillfully how to release our grasping so that we can realize the self that is unconditioned, that is free of history and appearances. Dogen said in another fascicle, Dogen says, rather than just loving the carved dragon, the dragon of your creation, go on and love the real dragon. But we should also learn that both the carved and the real dragons both have the ability to produce clouds and rain. They both bring moisture to the field. And in a sense, that means learn to love everything. What would you leave out? I was thinking about, for some reason this brought in my mind, when I was in high school, I was about 15, and I used to work all the way through high school after school. And I worked for several years in an animal hospital, a couple of different ones, and I was, in this particular time, I was saving money to go on a cross-country trip, which was usually why I was working during the summers. And in these hospitals, you know, there would be three-legged dogs. There would be dogs sometimes that couldn't use their back legs, and so we'd kind of harness them into these little sort of carriers, these little trailers. I remember a cat, somebody brought in a cat whose back had been broken and wanted it euthanized. And the doctor didn't, because he thought he might be able to help it with acupuncture. In fact, whenever he was doing acupuncture, he would say, close the door. He said, I don't want any of the customers to see me doing this. This was, you know, in the 70s. But what I was remembering was how these animals in all of these states, the dogs would always wag their tails. That when I scratched this cat with a broken back, she would purr. And it wasn't, I think, that they weren't suffering, but somehow there was still joy. There was still some delight in life. And in thinking about learning how to work with carved and real dragons, one Saturday I was there. On Saturdays, I was there alone. I went in to clean lots and lots of poop. Big part of my job. And I was there. They were the only one there. And somebody was leaning on the buzzer. We were close, so I wasn't answering it. But they kept leaning on it. So finally I went, and there was this woman who was very distraught. And she said, my dog is in the car, and she's pregnant. She's trying to have her litter, but she can't. Something's wrong. I'm afraid she's going to die. And she was really upset. And I said, I'm only 15 years old. Right? She said, can't you do something? So I went and called the doctor. And he said, tell them to go to the SPCA, because they're open. So I came back, and I told her that. And she said, we tried that, but they charge $100. And I don't have $100. And so I'm trying to, like, work with her. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, I have $100. In a sock in my drawer at home that I'm going to use to go on my bike trip. And she kept talking and talking, and finally I said, look, I have some money I can lend to you. And she was so grateful. So I closed up, I got on my bike, I rode home, they met me there. I thought anybody whose dog is this dear to her should be good for $100. And so, you know where this is going. So I gave her the money. She was very grateful. You know, we'll pay you. Don't worry. I got phone numbers, all of that. So a day goes by, a couple of days go by. I don't hear anything. So I call her up, says, hi. She said, she died. And I was like, oh, double heartbreak. I said, I'm so sad. And she said, I'll pay you. I don't have it right now. So day after day, I would call and call. And then finally, her boyfriend or husband said, we're not paying you. The dog's dead. Stop calling. So I went to my dad. Daddy, can you call them? Right? And rightly, he said, No, this is your thing. You can take care of this. I said, but they're not paying me. And he said, you can take care of this. And even as I wished he would do it, because I wanted my $100, I knew he was right. It wasn't his business. I needed to carry this through. And so, of course, I didn't get my money. And I remember thinking, even at that time, don't give up on people. I saw that there was that seed was there. Okay, you got burned once, don't get burned again. Right? This is the lesson you've just learned. And I remember thinking, no, don't learn that lesson. In the Eight Awarenesses, the Buddha says we have to practice with meticulous effort. And meticulousness is, as the Buddha says, exerting oneself meticulously and unceasingly in various beneficial practices is called meticulous effort. Be precise, not careless. Proceed forward, do not regress. And he likens it to the trickle of a small amount of water falling against a large rock. And you've seen them, right? In stream beds, rocks that you can know were huge and craggy and rough and are as smooth as a baby's behind. With these just simple water, soft water, tumbling against it. Meticulous effort. And speaking about that, Mizumi Roshi says, we recognize, in terms of practice, that it is necessary to have effort. We find that we can't just endeavor to do something. We have to endeavor in the right way. We have to endeavor skillfully. We have to bring forth a particular kind of effort, right? And we've experience all kinds of effort in our lives. but a particular kind of effort. And that may actually vary somewhat depending on the moment, you, the practice that you're engaged in, your mental dharma at that moment. And he says, so that it helps to move you in the right direction. But since there are so many alternatives that seem good or right, it's not clear always which direction is the best to choose. What is the right amount of effort? And so he says, in order to discover your own direction, it's important to have great faith in yourself. And then he goes on to talk about having faith in Buddha nature. And he says, what I want us to appreciate together is the nature of the direction these vows indicate for us. Just being compassionate, just be compassionate, is difficult to understand and fulfill. So often, what seems like should just be obvious and clear isn't, to actually alleviate suffering. It's not always clear. What is the right action? What is the right effort? How to fulfill that? Dogen says, the words, if you want to know Buddha nature, means if you want to know Buddha nature now. Implicit within that is now. So we don't practice. It's like, I'm going to practice today for some later time. I'm practicing for now. If I want to know Buddha nature, I want to know Buddha nature now. And he says, and you should know cause and effect over time. And our practices, don't put those against each other. Learn how to hold both of those. That I practice to enlighten my mind now, because otherwise I'm standing on the edge. I'm outside the door. But in being fully in, now, observe cause and effect over time. When the time is ripe, Dogen says, means that when the time is ripe, you will realize Buddha nature. When the time is ripe means that that time has arrived. When the time is right is now. The time has already arrived. There is a time of realizing Buddha nature, which we call now. There's a time in which we want to liberate ourselves, and the time of that is now. And as we are doing that, sincerely, we are practicing cause and effect over time. And both of those are in perfect accord. When we let them be. Dogen says, know that when the time is ripe means the 12 hours of the day are not passed in vain. You know, that's why it's important to really, at the beginning of session, to establish intention and then to practice that, to really stay true to that and keep endeavoring and being willing to extend yourself within this rigorous practice of session. We all come in knowing it's a rigorous practice. And what that, I mean, that just opens all the doors, but what it also allows us is that no matter what happens, then through every moment of now and over the course of time of this week, there are no regrets. Because you have done what you could do. You have been wholeheartedly in it. You are in the room for today, for now, not for tomorrow. And so then nothing is wasted. No opportunities are lost. And that when the time has arrived, Dogen says, doesn't mean that Buddha nature arrives, finally decides to show up. I've made you wait long enough. Okay, I'm here. It has arrived. And that is what we cultivate our faith in. Because then we can practice in accord with that, which is how we want to be practicing. And so in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, the Buddha said, good friends, it's like the pit inside of a mango fruit, which doesn't decay. When you plant it in the ground, it grows into the largest and most regal of trees and bears the most beautiful fruit. In the same manner, good friends, when I look at sentient beings with my clear vision, I see that the Buddha nature is surrounded by this husk of delusion, just as the seeds of a fruit are found in its core. If left unattended to, if left unheard, then that seed is left to be cold and unripe. And all along, the profound peace of liberation that is brought about by great wisdom is right there. And so Dogen says, this principle is self-evident. Generally, there is no time when the time has not arrived. How wonderful. There is no time in which the time has not arrived. There is no Buddha nature that is not already actualized. And so let us practice within that faith. And if we just stay close to the teachings, to the Dharma, and to trust in ourselves as those are brought in, then the time has arrived. And how and when and how frequently and how deeply we let go and shift and illuminate and realize, in a way, that's not your business anymore. It's not something for you to manage. It never was. Just like on that large, regal mango tree, it's filled with fruits, but they all ripen in their own time, right? They don't all drop at the same moment, right? I mean, think about that. That would be something, actually. But they don't. Each one. I remember asking my sister, who's a horticulturist, because there's some red maples on 28 going down towards Boyceville. And I've always noticed that there's one that first in the season is in the fall is scarlet. And I said, what's that about? And she said, it's personality. That each tree has a personality. And some hold it back. And some just can't wait. So, there is no time when the time has not arrived.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.